Good morning. The topic is spatial measurements of wind waves. And I'm the first to admit that that's not the most efficient way to do wave measurements. It's very expensive. You're talking about every so many millimeter or so many meter you have to put the sensor in on the ocean surface. But there's a reason we started with this spatial measurement, because when I started my first real job after graduating, the work was sponsored by a radar remote sensing program, and the purpose of the research is to understand the ocean surface roughness. That is important to radar remote sensing, which is usually a few centimeters wave, or maybe 20, 30 centimeter L band. Now, this kind of wave is subject to a convection of the current on the ocean surface. So, using the traditional way of measuring the frequency spectrum, have some problem of converting back to the wave number domain. So, getting the length scale is not an easy task. And I'll expand more later. That's how we get into the 1D scanning. So if time series give me a frequency spectrum, space series give me wave number spectrum, so I don't have to worry about this conversion of the dispersion relationship. And once you do a 1D scanning, you certainly want to do 2D when you have a chance, and I did have an opportunity to use NASA's airborne scanning LIDAR system, and was able to find some very interesting directional distribution of the ocean waves. And I'd like to make this the major part of our discussion. Some of that was presented Monday during the discussion series, and I found out that I'm not the only one get stumped by that observation. And then, of course, you want to go to 3D if you have the opportunity. I'll show you some results from this 3D scanning measurements. Now, this 1D and 3D are on the Capillary Gravity Wave range, and I'll present those first. Oops. And near the end, I want to say that once you get into 3D, the data quantity is really large, and it becomes a very heavy overhead just to look at the data. So we look at the alternative to make this kind of measurement, and we did find one that seems to be more efficient, and I'll show it at the end. Now, this is the typical scenario that we want to quantify these little bumps and waves on this background big waves. So it's a serious problem of signal to noise ratio. But that is a lesser problem, because we don't necessarily have to measure the wave height. If we measure the wave slope, then the short wave slope is on the same order as the long wave slope, and we can get decent resolution. And if we use a wave follower, that will cut down the long wave signal even further. So that's not our major problem. The major problem is, as I said, if you use a fixed point measurement, you will get this frequency spectrum. But the short wave is subject to convection from any source. And if you look at the ocean surface, it's very easy to get 50 centimeters per second of orbital velocity from waves, and you will be looking at the particular frequency components contributed by all kind of wave number. This is the wave number, and frequency is here. So if I do point measurement, I get the frequency spectrum. Any component, I need to convert it back to wave number. And that the contribution can come from many, many wave number components. And in order to unravel that, I will need to know the vector currents, and it's even more difficult measurement than the surface waves. If I do wave number measurement, then yeah, there's no problem. I'm saying that if I'm limited to point gauge, then I'll have to work on this unraveling of. Yes? Yes. Yes. Thank you. One is semi-log, one is linear scale, so it's equivalent. The line with plus is the one without current, so this is the intrinsic frequency. But once you have velocity convection, this is very simplistic scale. The convection term actually is stronger than the intrinsic term in this capillary-graphic wave range. No, this is just purely computation. Yeah. So as I said, trying to unravel this problem is just too difficult. It's involving a lot of hand waving, and we just bypass it by scanning a light over a distance, measure the space series, and get the wave number spectrum that way. And this is an example of a linear scanning that moves the laser over a distance. So each scan will provide me data to get wave number spectrum. I will still have the time series if I choose to. And so this is an evolution of small scale waves subject to modulation by long waves. So it's easy to do. And you can, of course, do two-dimensional scanning also. This is the system eventually we constructed with 2 millimeter in horizontal resolution and 20 milliseconds in time resolution. So,
are those pictures
40 centimeters on a side? No, this is pixels, so that's 8 centimeters a side. And this is actual ocean waves.
But it's
40 pixel, 40 points. So 40 times 2 milliseconds, 2 millimeters, that's 8 centimeter by 8 centimeter. Right. Yes, yes. So this waveform is about 2, 3 centimeters here. And I think the wind direction is in, or upwind, downwind is in this direction. So it varies very, very slowly. And the surface structure is quite complete.
Time, right?
Yeah, 20 milliseconds later, 20 milliseconds later. So this is a sequence of half seconds total here. There are 25 here, so that's half seconds.
Half seconds total, right?
Yeah. But that's comes in very. This is about 8 meter per second wind speed in the ocean. Yeah, yeah. And there's some laboratory measurements. This is 6 meter per fish, 8 meters per second wave down in Gilman's tank. See a lot of beautiful wave structure here. And a point was raised yesterday whether a Fourier representation will be the best way of doing this kind of analysis, and doesn't seem to be good, because obviously a lot of nonlinearities, and if you do Fourier transformation, you're splitting the wave component into many harmonics. But that's really not the topic I want to discuss today. The one I really want to show you is the larger scale from this airborne sensor. It's also a laser system. It's a laser light doing a circular scan on the ocean surface, taking measurement of the distance from the instantaneous ocean surface to the platform at every 1.5 meter spacing along these tracks. So the airplane moves this laser system along the flight line, and you are able to get ocean surface measurement in two dimension for as long as you fly. And we started to have this reasonably steady state condition, and the wind comes from northeast, so it's unblocked the duration limited. By the time reaching the airplane started the measurements, it's already 6 hours after this wind event started. So the wave field here really is almost equilibrium wave condition, very ideal textbook case for us to start this analysis. And this is a typical wave field coming out from this 2D. All the graphs I'm going to present is the x direction is in the flight line and y direction is cross flight. So I showed earlier the flight line is about 40 degrees from the wind vector, and you can see the wave more or less is in the downwind direction. And with the 2D wave field like this, you can generate a 2D wave number spectrum very easily, and you see the dominant energy located in the downwind direction as we expected. But look closely, if we go to shorter waves, suddenly we notice that the energy reach of the spectrum is deviating from the wind direction. In other words, for shorter waves, waves don't propagate downwind, and that's a trouble. Well, it's not etched in any stone, but we have held that as self-evident. Wind-generated waves should propagate downwind. After all, we are talking about steady wind generation, almost equilibrium conditions. And also, in many, many years, we have very credible measurement showing that indeed the directional distribution of wave energy is more or less cosine to the nth power. For dominant waves, it's very narrow beamed. For shorter waves, it becomes broader beams, and it's repeated at least 3-4 times in the last few years. Also, we also kind of implying that assumption in our wind input term. While we cannot agree how to scale the wind input term, whether it should be U star, U10, U lambda over 2, but when it comes to a directional distribution, we just put this cosine theta on U or U star and get it done with, and nobody seems to question about the validity of that assumption, because this seems to be very logical. But is it? So let's first try to understand why the airborne measurement is so different from what's reported in the past. Now, Sir Michael in the audience is the one pioneered this method to study the directional distribution. It's pretty much trying to find as many as possible the Fourier components of this directional distribution function. Then we will be able to get a very nice representation of the directional distribution of the wave field. And when we look at the airborne measurements, we see that the Fourier components really has very non-trivial variations up to I resolved the 10 Fourier components here. And in the old data, these were done by direction buoys, pitch and roll buoys. You only resolve two Fourier components. And if I were limited to only using two components to reconstruct the directional distribution, I will be getting similar distribution like this. Now, Dunlan used 14 wave gauges, so in principle, he can find out many more directional Fourier coefficients. But his emphasis was trying to find out the directional beamwidth, which is the integrated quantity, and really not a very good way to represent the wave directional distribution. In fact, based on this criterion, the agreement is much better in the higher wave numbers, where the direction distribution is probably the most difficult, different. So that explains why we see different directional distribution from earlier measurements, but it still doesn't explain why wave energy distribution should be bimodal. Turns out this is where nonlinear interaction comes in, or at least that seems to be a very good way to explain it. As we know, the wave interaction of surface gravity waves comes at the four wave as the lowest magnitude of interaction. What that means is you need four waves to interact to exchange energy. And wave spectrum pretty much is a very narrow beam. So if we make an assumption of almost the delta function type of spectrum with some background noise to provide these wave components for interaction, the energy path for interaction will come out something like this. This is using a discrete integration algorithm that's defined by Hasselman's group. They show that these two pairs of interaction curve will give you the dominant contribution. But a more complete full nonlinear interaction curve has been done by Ben and Yang back in 1994. And what he found is a very robust feature of bimodal distribution in the shortwave region. And that's our airborne data, which is a remarkable agreement. So we satisfied, I think we are quite satisfied about the result from this steady state condition. So let's try to emerge out from this sale of steady state and take some risk and look at some inhomogeneity, which development will satisfy this nicely. And again, we try to keep one variable constant, so look for a kind of quasi-steady state of environment. And this is the core front passing by this region, the weather system is really large. These two stations are about 150 kilometers away, and the history of wind wave seems to be reasonably steady. And we assume that the condition here is not very different from there. So what we are going to see different from here will be the phage, which we have a land mass here, and we fly out. So phage will start from almost zero. These are meters, yes. Yeah. So the wave here you see is pretty much deep water conditions out about 5-6 kilometers. And well, this is a typical case that you have to be careful what you wish for, because you really will get it. We were expecting to see some phase variations, but this is more than we have expected. And you can ignore these large scale waves, which is swell coming from offshore. This was about 2 days after Hurricane Mitch passed by. So we have these long waves. But the scale wave I want to bring to your attention is this quilt pattern, fabric pattern. But that fabric pattern is almost parallel to wind in the nearshore region. If you look at the spectrum, it's about 90 degrees from the wind speed. And we tried to simulate this with the wave model, and we never was able to do it right. But the pattern looks suspiciously familiar to a theory that proposed by Phillips back in the 57 on the turbulence generation of the wave field. What he's saying is wind carries a wide scale of turbulence, and each turbulence acts as a point impulse on the surface. You got a broadband of waves generated in broadband in wavelengths and broadband in wave direction, but there will be that particular conditions where U cosine satisfy equals to C, and that component will stay with wind field and get continuous nourishment from the wind, and that's the component we will be able to see. And based on that theory, then the younger C will propagate more normal to the wind direction, and as in this case here, and the older C will have a larger angle with this direction. But Phillips' theory has been discounted because the theory predicts the linear growth of the wave energy, and all experiment shows it's more like a shear instability of Myers mechanism, which is exponential growth. But the observation shows that somehow we have to marry this Phillips into Myers if we are going to get to the direction of the spectrum right.
Well, what's the frequency of waves, say,
0.2? 0.2 will be 30 meters. This is 2 pi over lambda. Will be about 4 to 5 seconds. By the way, I forgot to mention the resolution of the airborne system is about 3 meters spacing, so I cannot resolve very short waves. So the Nyquist is about 6 meters. Now, we really don't need a very high-tech instrument to see this kind of directional distribution. These are the pictures taken by the engineers on the airplane, and the same features is shown just by pictures. And this is somewhere in the middle, and the quilt pattern comes to be very organized at the further offshore. And this is repeatable. Since then, we were really obsessed to it and repeated several measurements by the same instruments. And near shore, you always see this. This is even higher wind, about 12 meters per second. And this is offshore. The wind is indicated by this bubble streak, but the wave is having a very large angle. And you probably can make an argument that there probably is this kind of wave pattern also. But picture is more orientation sensitive. And you don't need to be on the airplane to see this pattern. You probably can see a lot of scales with diamond shapes here, and there's some here, all kind of scales. This is in a lake which has a lot of background waves already, and a high wind blowing by. You see very strong pattern organized. And if you really want to see some nice pattern, go to some smaller water body. This is a navigation canal about 2 miles from my office. And it's oriented in the north-south direction. So in the winter time, we will have this north wind come by, and I'll jump on my bike right to there and take pictures of this. Very convenient. And my favorite is this one. It's in a Louisiana bayou. And I was taking a walk. A wind came by, and I turned my head. Oh, this woman's best friend shows up. It's really amazing how fast these patterns appear. So that's why, I think this is more of a wind wave generation problem than wave induction problem. And I want to say that this has been observed many, many times in the past. This is 65 book, and it's also just out a wind has sprung up. So It's a very fast process. And I want to say that if we want to solve Doppler frequency shift, taking spatial measurement is one method, but it's, again, when you get to 3D, it's a very expensive method. But when I was doing scanning design, I was toiling with the concept. If I want to solve this problem, I can. Another way is to make U minimum. That means if I do free drifting measurement, so my platform will be traveling with the current. And if U is zero, I don't even have to worry about it. And a few years ago, I had a chance to test out that concept and put my instrument in a fixed location. Then the measure, the spectrum deviate from dispersion relationship considerably. But when in free drift, it's beautiful. Dispersion curve shows up in this is downwind, this is crosswind by model. And look at the phase speed of small wave components. This is a scale from 10 to 100 wave number spectrum, and it follows the dispersion curve quite well. I use those data to look at the dissipation function, which I ran out of time, but what we found is the wave spectrum has a very weak wind speed dependent in the wave scale about 1 meter size, say 2.3 to 3 meter, it has a very weak wind dependence. The implication of that is we have almost delta function type of... that's the spectral function as represented as a power law function. So A0 is the coefficient and little A0 is the exponent. So the exponent is... B is spectrum. Right. Oops. B is normalized spectrum. Yeah. Saturation spectrum. So what it indicates is in the free short wave range there's a delta function like of dissipation term, and that's probably very similar to the flux argument. We use Hilbert's assumption of a power law. So it, again, is the exponent and coefficient. And this is 10 orders of magnitude. So you can pretty much treat it as a delta function. And very narrow beam. Back into 6 meters, you go back to this linear dependence of wind speed. Again, that's what we...
So, the dissipation is concentrated in very narrow...
Yes, about 0.3 meter to 2-3 meter range, and peak at 1 meter.
Oh, do you want to draw some conclusions?
Yeah, and that's my concluding view graph, which is my outline view graph. You have seen it already.